Hey, can I talk to you? Over 25 years ago, on September 29th, 1998, we watched a brainy girl with curly hair drop everything to follow a guy she only kind of knew all the way to college. And so began Felicity. My name is Juliette Littman, and I'm a Felicity superfan. Join me, Amanda Foreman, who you may know better as Megan, the roommate, and Greg Grunberg, who you may also know as Sean Blunberg, as the three of us revisit our favorite moments from the show and talk to the people who helped shape it. Listen now to Dear Felicity on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode of The Town is brought to you by FX's The Bear, starring Jeremy Allen White, Ayo Edebiri, and Eben Moss Backrack. Season 2 follows as the crew work to transform their grimy sandwich joint into a next-level spot. It turns out the only thing harder than running a restaurant is opening a new one. Television Academy members can watch all episodes at fxnetworks.com/FYC.
This episode is brought to you by Vuori. I love sports. I know you do too. I also know that lots of you exercise, but if you're like me and my wife, the beloved sports gal, you're sick and tired of ugly, uncomfortable workout gear. Especially, you know, I do a lot of walking. I walk around LA. I make calls. I listen to podcasts. Here are two words that will change everything. Vuori clothing. A line of activewear that is unbelievable. The best thing about Vuori is you can lounge around in it. You can work out in it. You can go outside. You can go shopping down in your local wherever. And you never feel like you're either underdressed or overdressed. You're just comfortable. You can wear it when you're training, traveling, lounging around the house. Go get yourself some of the most comfortable and versatile clothing on the planet. Here's the deal. Our listeners get 20% off their first purchase at Vuori.com/Simmons. Once again, Vuori.com/Simmons.
It is Friday, March 15th. It's a story as old as Hollywood. Screenwriter finishes a script, sends it off to his or her agent or manager. They take it out to the town, try to get a star or director attached. Then there's no takers. And weirdly, another very similar project pops up, eerily similar. And the writer discovers that the talent involved in that project had access to his first script. Happens all the time. And last week, a writer named Simon Stevenson, he wrote the Pixar movie Luca, he claimed that The Holdovers, the Oscar-nominated script by David Hemmingson, that was plagiarized from his script called Frisco, he says, which was on the prestigious blacklist in 2013 and on two separate occasions was in the possession of Alexander Payne, who went on to commission The Holdovers script and direct it. Stevenson told the WGA that his script was, quote, plagiarized line by line from Frisco, and that anyone who reads both will believe the theft to be, quote, brazen. I'm not so sure. I read most of Frisco. It's online. There are thematic similarities and even some similar scene constructions, but Frisco is about a middle-aged doctor who looks after a terminally ill teen girl. The Holdovers is, of course, about an underachieving boarding school instructor who is stuck watching students over the winter break. It's an odd situation, and I think that the press coverage of it was sort of inflammatory. But the situation does bring up an interesting legal issue in Hollywood, and that's the standard for copyright infringement, so-called idea submission claims. They're both pretty tough, and it means there's got to be more than just similar ideas, or even themes, or even characters. Back when I was a lawyer, we would sometimes get calls on situations like this, and we almost never took the cases because they're hard to win. That's what we're talking about today. I've got Jeremiah Reynolds in here. He's a friend of mine from law school who has become a well-known entertainment litigator at the Eisner firm. He handles a bunch of cases like this. We're going to go through the holdover situation, as well as the broader question of what is protectable in a script and what's not, what role the Writers Guild has here, if any. And also why so many pissed off writers have very few options when they think they've been ripped off. From The Ringer and Puck, I'm Matt Bellany, and this is The Town. All right, we are here with Jeremiah Reynolds, who, in addition to being a friend of mine, we went to law school together. He is a partner at Eisner LLP in Beverly Hills, specializing in entertainment litigation. And he's here to talk about one of my favorite topics, fights, disputes in the entertainment industry. Welcome, Jeremiah.
Great to be on the show, Matt.
I know 20 years ago in law school, your dream was to come on my podcast and talk about how you can protect your script.
My dream has been fulfilled.
It's a high point. It's definitely a high point. Oh, so sad. All right. So let's get into this, because I saw this story about the holdovers situation, and I read the Variety story. I looked at what this guy was claiming, and I was like, okay. So I looked at the script, and like, it kind of falls apart. I feel bad for this guy, and we're going to talk about some of the potential remedies when you feel that your script has been ripped off. I'm not saying that Alexander Payne didn't read this. He probably did read this, and he probably, you know, got some impressions of it, but the standard is higher than that. So take us through your reaction when you read this.
Yeah, the article was interesting. It went viral. I saw it in many places, and I immediately
became interested. That's not always a good thing.
Yeah, that's not always a good thing. And you know, I wanted to dig into this because, you know, what often happens in Hollywood is lawyers like myself will frequently see claims like this, where someone will come to us, an author, and they think, you know, my script has been ripped off, and they'll have a general idea of why they've been ripped off. And it'll be very similar to the presentation we see here. And then you take a look at it, and you have to explain to the author that, no, under our standard of copyright, this is not a winning case. And I did a review of the script here. I also read what this gentleman put together, what he apparently submitted to the WGA. And this is exactly the type of case where I would say, you know, maybe there's some general plot similarities here, but this is not going to pass muster under copyright law.
So the standard is you have to show access and similarity. Access is pretty obvious. Did this person have access to the material that is alleged to have been copied? Here we've got it pretty clearly. Alexander Payne was sent the script, is said to have read it twice. There's pretty good evidence of that. So that's not the question. The question is substantial similarity. And that is, you know, we used to always say ideas are free as the air. And you have to show that the expression of those ideas has been copied. And that means dialogue. It means exact scene structure and character and all of the things that a reasonable person would look at and say, oh, this is the same script.
That's exactly right, Matt. Courts always say that no one can own the basic idea for a story. So this basic notion of something like the hero's journey, that's in the public domain. What a court does when you're trying to analyze whether there has been copyright infringement is they go through an objective test that looks at a bunch of different elements, a plot, they look at themes, they look at dialogue, they look at mood, they look at the setting, they look at the pace of the screenplay, the characters, the sequence of events. Each of those are compared. And then we see if there's enough for a finding of potential substantial similarity.
So, you know, the famous cases are like the Coming to America case, Art Buchwald. He won, and it was a pretty obvious case of just lifting what he had done. I don't want to get into the details, but give me some examples of other situations that have been analyzed by courts and what the result was. Because I think people would be shocked by how similar some things have been and lost.
Yeah, so we went through a period of years where it became increasingly difficult to establish, particularly in the area of screenplays, a copyright claim. And I want to give you an example of a case from 2006, which involved Six Feet Under. And what happened there is the writer of a script called The Funk Parlor had a chiropractor who knew Chris Albrecht, who was the head of HBO at the time. And she wanted to pass along this script called The Funk Parlor to Chris Albrecht, which she apparently did. Now, let me just read you briefly what the description was of The Funk Parlor. The Funk Parlor takes place in a small, family-run funeral home in Connecticut. John Funk Sr., the patriarch, has committed suicide. And the deteriorating funeral parlor has been handed down to his two sons, John Jr. and Tom. Now, anyone who saw Six Feet Under remembers it takes place in the funeral home, and it starts with the death of the patriarch, Nathaniel, and the return of the prodigal son, Nate, who comes back and runs the funeral home. Now, many people thought that this would be sufficient at least to get to a trial on an issue of copyright infringement. And the court said no. The court said, essentially, you have high-level similarities in the plots, but the actual expression, the actual scenes, the actual sequence, the structure of the two works was too different to even get to a trial. And so that case was dismissed before it ever went to a jury.
So even if Chris Albrecht at HBO read that script, said, love it, I'm already working with Alan Ball, let's give the idea to Alan Ball and have him do it. And he does essentially the same show, but in the style of Alan Ball and with the expression of Alan Ball, this court said that that is not enough for infringement.
That's right. And I should mention that 3 months after the script allegedly went to Chris Albrecht, Chris Albrecht's lieutenant had reached out to Alan Ball to pitch him on the idea of doing 6 Feet Under.
That's not a good fact for them.
Not a good fact. And even that was not enough for the court. And this brings up a basic misunderstanding about copyright law, which is some amount of copying is allowed. You are allowed, if you like, for instance, a general plot idea from a film or a story, you can take that as long as your expression is not substantially similar.
Yeah, that's the key here. And that's why I think back when I was practicing, we would always focus on the potential contract claim in a script submission situation. And let's go into that, because if the high bar for copyright is something you don't want to try, you can actually allege a claim called a breach of an implied contract, meaning I sent you this script, we had a meeting, there was an implied contract that you would develop my script, and you breached that deal by taking the idea and giving it to Alan Ball or whoever. And I'm going to sue you for contract damages. That is where a lot of these claims actually end up going. And you can go to state court on that, and you know, you could potentially win a case like that. Is that, as a lawyer who looks at these, do you more often recommend that course of action?
Well, it depends on the facts. I mean, there are the upside of what we call sometimes an idea theft claim is you do not have to have a protectable copyright to prevail on an idea theft claim. So even a non-novel, you don't have to prove novelty to protect an idea as long as you prove the elements of the contract, which is, you know, commonly what happens, right? The common fact pattern we will see in Hollywood is someone goes to a pitch and pitches a general idea for a show. There's some discussion, perhaps even of a credit or compensation, and then the idea is used without compensation. That's sort of the prototypical idea theft claim. Now, it doesn't always work, and I'll give you an example. In this case, for instance, it doesn't seem that there's any evidence that there was ever a meeting between Alexander Payne and this screenwriter or his team where this would have been discussed. So you have to look at the facts of every case and decide, does this fit within a copyright fact pattern, or is this more like an idea theft claim?
And it's hard for people, let's say you're Joe Blow screenwriter, you're Craig, and Craig has written his coming of age story about being a Warriors fan in the Bay Area in the 90s and 2000s, and it's brilliant. And someone comes along and copies it. It's hard to get a good lawyer to look at this because the cases on copyright are so tough, and you don't want to pay a lawyer an hourly fee to litigate this. And no lawyer is going to take a contingency case when the odds are so stacked against the writer. So it really, you see where this holdovers guy sort of felt like out in the cold where he couldn't, you know, I assume he was shopping for a lawyer. I don't know that, but I assume he was shopping for a lawyer and ended up going to his guild, the Writers Guild, for help here. Is that a viable option? What can the Writers Guild do here?
Yeah, well, the Writers Guild can't help with any type of copyright, plagiarism, or idea theft claim. They do have, as you know, a credit process.
Yeah. Well, first of all, why can't they help you with a idea theft claim? They're just not going to get involved in litigation like that?
The basic guild agreement governing the Writers Guild does not cover this type of dispute. So it's not within the structure of the guild to adjudicate this type of copyright or idea theft claim. But there is sometimes a misunderstanding among writers who think that the credit dispute process, which resolves whether someone should get any writing credit or whether it should be written by or screenplay by or story by, that can be used in this type of context. And as you can read in the Variety article, the Guild will not use that process to adjudicate this type of plagiarism claim.
So if you are Craig, and unfortunately Ana de Armas has passed, I'm playing your girlfriend in this script that you sent around town, and someone else steals your idea, and you can't get a lawyer because the copyright claims are probably not winnable, and the idea theft claim is potentially a little more winnable, but still tough. You go to the guild, and the guild essentially can't help you. Where are you then?
Well, you can always file a case yourself, and they happen. I mean, I do see pro per parties.
Yeah, but nobody takes that seriously.
No one takes it seriously. So you're basically out of luck at that point. I mean, you can try it. You know, the other major problem facing someone who wants to bring this type of claim, particularly here in California, we're covered by what's called the Ninth Circuit for federal courts, is you're going to eventually need an expert to come in and provide a report to the court about the similarities between the two works. And that is not an inexpensive proposition to get someone who is a legitimate expert who will go through both works and provide you an analysis that you can present to the court.
Yeah, I've seen those. Those are interesting because it's kind of exactly what you would think. It's a former studio executive or someone who has a lot of experience reading scripts, literally going through each of them and saying, what happens? How it's similar or different. There's usually a Venn diagram of some sort, and they ultimately come to a conclusion at the end as to whether this is or is not copying.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's not only executives. I mean, some of the best people in town who do this are also screenwriters. And, you know, one point I would say to someone like the writer Frisco, the best people to tell you whether there has been an infringement are your fellow screenwriters. You know, if you have two or three friends who will give you honest advice that you can pass along a script like this.
Yeah, say, but hey. Honest advice would be great. But every writer thinks they've been ripped off. That's just sort of how they think, right? If I imagine this Frisco guy probably did ask his writer friends, and they're like, "Oh man, you got bamboozled here. Sue." I almost feel like you need an outsider to read it and try to say, "Oh, this is similar," or "No, these movies wouldn't be the same to me." Like, do they often have other writers testify on their behalf?
Oh, for sure.
Interesting.
Yes, this does happen quite a bit, and you're right. And often those writers are biased. I had a case involving an alleged infringement of the movie Ad Astra, and one of the primary reasons that the plaintiff ended up filing it and we got it dismissed was he had asked a friend, a fellow writer, to comment on it and say, you know, is this an infringement? And of course, like you just said. That's why I caution my note, which is you got to find someone who's going to really be honest with you about this. I do think there are screenwriters out there, and I mean, this is something that the Guild could consider, which is they do have panels of screenwriters who could look at something like this and tell someone like Mr. Stevenson, do you really have a case here or not? And that would save, you know, everyone perhaps a lot of money and time and you know, this
That's
sort
a good
of
idea.
Public exposure. Yeah. And it's something the Guild could certainly do.
The Guild could like hire lawyers like you to be on a panel with a screenwriter to kind of give the honest truth. We think this is copying. We think this is not copying.
Well, they already sort of do this. I mean, with the credit arbitration, they select three neutral screenwriters who adjudicate the credit. So it is part of that process.
And that happens on almost every movie where, correct, you know, the writers submit their drafts and this panel determines who gets the credits. And it's a very structured and often disputed process where, you know, if you are a writer director, it's harder for you to get a writing credit on a project that you're also directing. And they try to, you know, maintain the story by credit if there's an original script that people completely rewrite. You know, there's a lot of like politics and nuance to it, but they are essentially evaluating who wrote what and what is original in each draft. They could do that from a legal perspective.
Yeah, so it would have to be advisory, of course, right? Because, you know, unless the other screenwriter agreed to participate in that process and potentially be found liable, but at least it could be an advisory opinion where, you know, there could be an objective basis before someone, you know, goes out and files a lawsuit and spends a lot of money on it.
This episode is brought to you by Vuori. I love sports. I know you do too. I also know that lots of you exercise, but if you're like me and my wife, the beloved sports gal, you're sick and tired of ugly, uncomfortable workout gear, especially, you know, I do a lot of walking. I walk around LA. I make calls. I listen to podcasts. Here are two words that will change everything. Vuori clothing, a line of activewear that is unbelievable. The best thing about Vuori is you can lounge around in it. You can work out in it. You can go outside. You can go shopping down in your local wherever. And you never feel like you're either underdressed or overdressed. You're just comfortable. You can wear it when you're training, traveling, lounging around the house. Go get yourself some of the most comfortable and versatile clothing on the planet. Here's the deal. Our listeners get 20% off their first purchase at Vuori.com/Simmons. Once again, Vuori.com/Simmons.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
What's a case that somebody won?
Well, you named the most famous one, which is Coming to America.
But beyond that, I mean, that was 40 years ago now.
Yeah, the other one that's been reported, and I don't know if it went to, it ended up settling, is the Shape of Water case involving Guillermo del Toro, which apparently settled. I don't know how that turned out. It could be a settlement, which was a walkaway, but it did survive motions to dismiss and went up on appeal and came back down. So, you know, you can infer in a case like that there probably was a settlement.
And who was the plaintiff?
It was a playwright named Paul Zindel, who had his estate had accused Guillermo del Toro of lifting elements of Zindel's play, Let Me Hear You Whisper. That case survived dismissal and ended up settling before trial.
I mean, that's a very specific movie. It's about a fish man who has essentially a romantic relationship with a woman. Like,
as I said earlier, recently the Ninth Circuit, which covers California, has made it seemingly easier at least to get by the initial stages on a copyright claim. So we went for years where it looked like copyright was almost dead in the Ninth Circuit. And starting in about 2019, there have been a few cases that have been reversed by the Ninth Circuit, which were dismissed by district courts and then revived by the Ninth Circuit. And it seems now that the Ninth Circuit at least wants cases to get past that initial stage of a complaint and have the court look at some facts and some expert. Importantly, the Ninth Circuit wants the courts to look at expert testimony before deciding whether to dismiss the case.
Interesting. The funniest thing about the holdovers dispute is that Alexander Payne actually says that they did copy a movie in making this. He cites a 1935 movie called Merluce that you actually looked up, and which is still in copyright, by the way. And you sent me the plot summary of Merluce. I'm going to read it to you now. Merluce is a teacher in an all-boys boarding school. Pupils hate him since he smells, has a glass eye, and is very strict. When Christmas Eve arrives, most boys leave school to spend the holidays with their families, but a small group of lonely boys is left behind with Merluce as their overseer. It goes on from there. I mean, that sounds a lot more like the holdovers than anything in Frisco.
Yeah, I mean, that is really similar, again, at that level of plot. And this is a really interesting story because Merluce had apparently fallen into the public domain. I did a little bit of research on this, but there was a treaty back in the 1990s called the Uruguay Round Agreements Act. And this was one of the films that in 1996 was restored to copyright protection. And I have no idea if Alexander Payne knows this when he sort of said that.
Well,
this was
you
the
should certainly be in touch with the estate of the writer of Merluce and inform Alexander Payne about this.
Well, who says I'm not? You know, it will be interesting to see if the author of Frisco ends up bringing a case. You know, if you read on the internet now, a lot of people have weighed in on this. And
yeah, not favorably. I did an item in my newsletter talking to the producer of Frisco, the guy who's been attached to produce Frisco for 10 years. And he said he's seen the holdovers twice and it never occurred to him that it might be plagiarized from a script that he's producing. And he had Alexander Payne come to his film school class at Loyola and talk about the movie, which he doesn't think Alexander Payne would have done had he been plagiarizing the script that this guy is producing.
Yeah, that's some pretty good evidence of lack of intent.
Yeah, I don't know. Do you think this guy will get, I mean, I don't want to say whether he'll get a lawyer or not, because you never know why people take cases, but seems like a pretty uphill battle.
Yeah, I think he definitely has an uphill battle. We'll see, though. I mean, you know, there have been many weaker cases filed, much weaker than even this one. So I would not be shocked if we see a lawsuit, particularly with all the press coverage that this has received. I mean, this did go viral.
It seemed like a trial balloon, and it was certainly written in a way that made it seem like a big deal, and you had to actually do the research to realize it's kind of not that big of a deal. So this seems like he wanted this story out there potentially to help himself get a lawyer, but we'll see. All right, Jeremiah, thanks for coming on. Appreciate your time.
Thanks, Matt.
We are back with the call sheet. Craig, are you following the euphoric reviews from the South by Southwest Film Festival?
It's impossible to miss. And I was sending you a lot of the reviews that, you know, Civil War is a fucking masterpiece.
Riveting, unflinching, visceral.
Yeah, and you informed me, I didn't really know this, that you said, ignore South by Southwest, everyone there is famously high. And I had to follow up on that. And it's true. So you're saying that they just bring in stoner fans to watch and laud these movies.
Yeah, well, I do not know that they have done official drug testing. I'm just using that as a catch-all for the type of people that go to the South by Southwest Film Festival premieres. They are very enthusiastic fans. They want to love this stuff. The studios for years have taken advantage of that, and they stock this festival. It's not a market like a Sundance or a Cannes or something like that where you're trying to get a distribution deal. These are films that have distribution or are major studio films. They bring them to South by Southwest to attempt to generate buzz from a very receptive audience that they can then translate into good press and marketing materials, and hopefully that will carry them through the release of the film in spring or summer, hence why you see the The Fall Guy, why you see the Dev Patel movie, Monkey Man, why you see Civil War, as you mentioned, couple others. And lo and behold, the reviews are all ecstatic. They love these movies. They're the greatest movies of all time.
Yeah, The Fall Guy was compared to like a combination of Lethal Weapon, Fletch, and one other, you know, incredibly successful comedy. It's the greatest Ryan Gosling performance they've ever seen. This movie is going to be a massive hit. So yeah. what is your prediction coming out?
My prediction is, calm down, people. None of these movies is a masterpiece. And that for most of them, probably excepting The Fall Guy, the box office prospects are not nearly what these reviews would suggest. And we go back. I mean, there's a long history of this going back years. I mean, the most recent that I remember was Long Shot, that Seth Rogen, Charlize Theron
Which
comedy.
People like that movie. It didn't do well, but people like that movie.
People like the movie, but it didn't do well because the regular movie-going audience is not the South by Southwest audience. And this is true of all film festivals. You see these reviews come out of festivals and they're very positive. And then, you know, the real critics get a hold of them and they're like less positive. And then audiences get a hold of them and they are even worse. But yeah, so my prediction is that these South by films are just not going to do what people think they are. I know that's not revolutionary, but I think we need to at least throw a little cold water on this stuff.
Civil War is the only one I think could potentially pop because of...
Really? See, I actually think that's the least likely to be commercial.
Oh, really? Election year, it's called Civil War. It's about America, like, you know, descending into madness. I don't know.
Maybe, but you know what? You can watch it on CNN.
People, young people aren't watching CNN.
That's true. That's true. All right. That's the show for today. I want to thank my guest, Jeremiah Reynolds. I want to thank producer Craig Horlbeck, our editor, Jesse Lopez. And I want to thank you. We will see you next week.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.